I'm Antonia Yuhas, and you're listening to KGNU Radio. Our guest this morning is Emily Holden. She's an environment reporter for The Guardian newspaper in the U.S., and she joins us from Washington, D.C. Thanks for being with us, Emily.
Thank you for having me.
Emily's been reporting on the various machinations of the oil and gas industry, seeking relief from the federal government in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. The industry was, of course, hard hit by a price war at the start of the pandemic between Russia and Saudi Arabia, followed by a historic collapse of demand as people sequestered in their homes. The price of crude fell for the first time to below zero in April, as a world that was already pre-COVID facing a glut of oil supply found itself basically drowning in the stuff. The result has led many to question the very fate of the industry as a whole. So we're going to start off taking a brief step back, looking at the condition of the oil and gas industry, especially the fracking sector, prior to COVID-19. Can you tell us what you've been reporting on, Emily?
Sure. Essentially, we started seeing that some of the small and medium-sized oil and gas companies, so not the majors, not the really big household names, but other companies in the U.S. were taking these Paycheck Protection Program forgivable loans from the federal government that are meant for small businesses. And so I started taking a look at how some of these companies were doing before the coronavirus pandemic and talked to analysts and essentially got the picture that, you know, we were in a period of time where a lot of these companies had been borrowing heavily for years, essentially to fuel their work in the fracking boom, and had gotten to the point where, you know, investors just really didn't want to lend them money anymore. And so we were looking at a time when we were expecting to see, you know, bankruptcies and consolidation in the industry and some of these companies really disappearing as they exist now.
And that's because many of those companies were severely in debt prior to COVID-19, right? They had been producing at a loss for years and suffering from debt and bankruptcies, you know, basically producing a product that a lot of the world is trying pretty hard to get off of and producing it in record amounts, making it pretty and costly, because fracking is costly, making it pretty hard to make a profit.
Yeah, that's right. And investors were really kind of finally getting to the point where they said, you know, we were putting our money in this because it was growing constantly, and it's usually a safe bet to invest in something that's growing, but we're not really seeing the value that we would hope that we would see. As one analyst put it to me, you know, speaking off the record, they said that, you know, they had talked to a portfolio manager who said, you know, I cannot bring another oil company back as a possible investment. Like I can't even mention it. You know, it's not something that is feasible for us to continue to do anymore because it's really just not seen as a good investment.
Okay. So that's the environment coming into the crisis. Then we, of course, as I described, have this crash in demand, which was already struggling in a world trying to get off of oil, and then the crash in demand, the crash in the price, and an industry that definitely is suffering even further. Can you talk about, you're in DC, you know, what have been the efforts by the oil and gas industry to try to receive relief as a result of the COVID-19 crisis?
So kind of on the record, you've seen oil and gas industry executives come and meet with President Trump. And the readout from that was that they basically said, you know, we don't want special treatment, but make it so that we can participate in all the aid that any other industry would be getting, so that, you know, we can get small business loans. So, you know, we could be part of a stimulus package. And behind the scenes, I think you've seen them asking for a little bit more. I reported on a letter that was from the Independent Petroleum Association of America on April 15th to the Federal Reserve, basically asking for this new provision from the Fed that would let them borrow from a program that they previously couldn't. And they said, I quoted them in this letter saying, oil and natural gas producers are not looking for a government handout. They are seeking a bridge to help survive this economic disruption.
And so you've got lobbying efforts taking place, meeting. You had also reported on this April meeting with the Trump administration that was both large oil companies and smaller companies. And then, you know, different programs that they have been able to take advantage of. Can you talk about the different, you know, ways that you've reported on the companies benefiting so far?
Yeah, so essentially there's the Paycheck Protection Program that we've talked about. There's the Fed's Main Street Lending Program, which essentially they're expanding a program to let companies with already existing large amounts of debt use the Main Street Lending Program to borrow to pay off existing loans. And so a lot of the environment advocates and the oil and gas analysts I talked to who looked at this decision said, you know, it might not explicitly say that this is happening to help oil and gas companies, but that's largely who it would benefit. One that they pointed out frequently is Occidental Petroleum, which has nearly $80 billion in liabilities on its balance sheet.
Let's actually go back because we didn't talk about the Paycheck Protection Program. So let's start there. What the Paycheck Protection Program is, and then what it was intended to cover, and how it's how it has covered oil and gas companies.
So the Paycheck Protection Program is this program passed by Congress, signed by the president, to allow small businesses, by the definition of the government, to apply for loans from banks, and if they spend those loans on continuing to pay salaries and on things like recurring expenses like utilities, then those loans are essentially forgiven. So we're calling them loans, but they're really payments from the government. And what we started to see, there's not a lot of oversight or transparency over this program, and so there's no list released of all of the companies that have gotten loans under this program. But I went back through SEC filings and found that for publicly traded oil and gas and coal companies, I believe the total now is at maybe, I think it was over $100 million that they had received under this program. And that's a really narrow picture. That's a sliver of what the industry is probably getting. And, you know, it's not to say that these aren't technically small businesses according to the government's definition, but when you start to look at their profiles, many of them have hundreds of employees, they have large market cap. You know, they're really not the kind of companies that I think most Americans would look at and think, yeah, that's a small business.
And it is very difficult to get this information. I believe, as you said, most people are looking at SEC filings because there isn't just a list that the federal government's putting out of recipients. But of course, SEC filings only apply to publicly traded companies, and a lot of fracking companies are privately held companies. They're small privately held companies. So do you feel that that's a place where there's, you know, a particular potential gap and where we're seeing companies that might be benefiting from the Paycheck Protection Program?
Absolutely. And I don't think that it's possible that we'll never know exactly how much money the industry has gotten through this program. But if we do find out, it's going to take years and years. And that will mean that the government really hasn't been able to come over adequate scrutiny for the role that it's playing in supporting this industry at a time when the world scientists say that we have to stop taking oil and gas out of the ground now.
And so you also are looking at, so you mentioned that the industry lobbied to get the Federal Reserve's Main Street Lending Program essentially expanded so that it could benefit more fossil fuel companies. Can you just revisit that and talk a little bit more about the lobbying that went into that and then what the result was?
Yeah, so this was the April 15th letter that I was talking about from the Independent Petroleum Association of America. And they were basically saying that, you know, oil and gas producers aren't able to use this program the way it works currently because they, you know, they have too much debt. So they just don't meet the requirements for the program. And so the change, you know, while it wasn't said to be directly benefiting the oil and gas industry, it was something that they asked for, and it is something that will benefit them.
So basically they were, as we were saying, heavily indebted. The Main Street Lending Program wasn't designed to help indebted companies. And one of the benefits of the lobbying by the oil and gas industry was that the definition was expanded to help companies that were indebted, not just oil and gas companies, but more indebted companies.
Specifically companies that had a large amount of debt.
Large amount of debt. Okay, thank you. So then you'd also written that there's another Federal Reserve plan. This, like, it's like a $500 billion plan, if I'm right, to offer buy bond backs, and that this has the potential to benefit some of the larger oil and gas companies.
Yeah, this was actually a story from my colleague Fiona Harvey, and it was looking at an analysis that was done by an environmental advocacy group on the buyback program broadly. So this isn't something that's being written just for fossil fuel companies, but they did an analysis and found that, you know, of the federal government's coronavirus bond buyback program, there are, you know, a lot of fossil fuel companies, coal-powered utilities, and fossil fuel-invested companies that could benefit from the bond buyback program. That doesn't mean they necessarily will, but it's a really major package of money, and it's another way that they could seek aid from the federal government.
Okay. Also, other reporters, let's see, from Bloomberg, have looked at a provision in the CARES Act that gives greater latitude on how to deduct recent losses, basically a tax benefit that has allowed 37 oil companies, service firms, and contractors to get nearly $2 billion in tax benefits as a result of that provision. And then High Country News reported on the Bureau of Land Management instructing Western state directors to look at royalty breaks for the royalties that companies are supposed to pay on removing oil from federal lands. So that's another provision. So we've got this sort of list of ways that the industry is seeking to benefit. What has been some of the response, some of the pushback from Democratic or other lawmakers? How are they responding to these provisions?
You see a lot of Democrats saying this is not what this money is supposed to be spent on. We should not be bailing out the fossil fuel industry at the same time that the science says that this is an industry that needs to be waning for all of us. And then you see some other more moderate Democrats who aren't in a position to be as aggressive on that stance because, you know, they have oil and gas companies in their districts, and some of this money is being used to pay the salaries of workers. But that does kind of perpetuate the business, you know, that keeps those companies in business at a time when they might have folded otherwise. But at the same time, Democrats helped to pass this package of aid. So they were also responsible in signing off for these programs that didn't really have the necessary oversight and transparency protocols that they possibly could have.
I mean, as you say, a lot of this, some of this money at least, is directed towards, you know, paychecks, making sure that people who are working in these sectors continue to work in these sectors. And of course, you know, the oil and gas industry is here. It's a major player in the state of Colorado, and you don't want to have an overnight sudden collapse of an industry. It sort of begs the question as to why you wouldn't also be looking towards how do you transition workers away from fossil fuels, and that this sort of key missing piece is, you know, you don't want to let an industry just collapse upon itself, but you do want to move forward on transitioning those employees, transitioning those workers. So, you know, that's where the idea of the green stimulus came, the Green New Deal, of how do you provide that support while transitioning.
Right. And this is, I think, kind of at the core political debate happening here in DC, which is, you know, should the government be giving money to companies to pay salaries, or should the government just be giving money to people so that they can spend it on food and bills, and so they can keep buying things and keeping the economy moving? And then you do see Democrats starting to talk about, you know, what requirements can we put on this money that's going out? If we know that we have this need to green our infrastructure, and we also are going to be spending historic amounts, huge amounts to try to rescue our economy, what should we be focusing on? But that hasn't really translated into the debate or the legislation that we're seeing coming out. And I think that's going to be pretty difficult for Democrats to do, especially in an election year. And especially with, you know, so many of them having oil and gas companies or fossil fuel companies in their districts.
Does it seem like for now, between now and the election, the discussion on a green stimulus package or a Green New Deal just isn't going to happen? What about in the infrastructure stimulus bill that had been being discussed? Do you see a push on the Hill to at least make a case for?
I think you see a huge push for it. The question is how much leverage Democrats will have, because if it comes down to you know, limiting money that's going to the oil industry, or spending money on green infrastructure versus, you know, not putting out more stimulus at all, that puts them in a really difficult position. You know, are they gonna refuse to move forward on a package that would help people in a lot of ways, just to make sure that they get these provisions? And I think that's what it's going to come down to for them.
These issues are so critical to communities, some of the hardest hit, you've reported on some of the hardest hit communities being hit by COVID-19 are also those communities that have faced historic environmental racism, the fence line communities to refineries, to fossil fuel operations, that have suffered long-term exposure to pollution, pollutants, and with long-term health impacts, are also those communities that are facing some of the highest COVID-19 rates. Can you talk about that reporting?
Yeah, so what we're seeing is a real racial disparity in the people who are dying from, who are contracting and dying from the coronavirus. So we know that a lot of people of color they're more likely to be frontline workers, so they're being exposed more to the virus. And we know that a lot of people who get the virus and die are those that already have chronic illnesses, that don't have access to healthcare, or, you know, sound nutrition before that, that don't have outdoor space, that aren't able to exercise. You know, the list goes on and on of things that affect the health of, you know, poor people and communities of color. And we're seeing that people who already had those existing issues are getting way, way harder hit by the coronavirus. It's not an equal opportunity killer.
Can you talk about some of those communities that you reported on?
Yeah, sure. So we looked at five different communities that just really stood out to us as being hit particularly hard by the coronavirus, some of them in numbers and some just, you know, in hospital capacity. And one that I looked at was Detroit, Michigan and Wayne County. So at that point, they've had far more deaths than this now, but Wayne County had a death rate of 40 per 100,000 people at that point, and that was 250% higher than the statewide average then. And Detroit, which is in Wayne County, had the country's 12th worst soot pollution in 2019.
I encourage listeners to check out all of your reporting. We've basically gone through three or four different articles that you've written just in the last about month in this 15-minute discussion. So please check out Emily Holden's reporting. She's the environment reporter at the Guardian newspaper of the U.S. She's joining us today from Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for being with us, Emily.
Thank you.
This is KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins.
My name's Antonia Yuhas, and you're listening to KGNU Radio. Our next guest is Navina Sadasivam. She is a staff writer at Grist. Her past reporting has been with the Texas Observer, Inside Climate News, and ProPublica. She's joining us today from San Francisco. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Antonia.
So you've been doing a lot of great reporting over the years, and including in the wake of the COVID-19 crisis. And your latest article is looking at the impact of a pretty critical rule change by the Trump administration in March at the start of the COVID-19 crisis, relaxing environmental enforcement rules during the COVID-19 pandemic. Can you start with that rule change so that listeners understand what happened at that time?
So shortly after state governors began shutting down operations in various states, the EPA towards the end of March announced an enforcement discretion policy, where they basically said that a number of reporting and compliance requirements were no longer going to be scrutinized in quite the same way. So businesses that were operating under various air quality and water permits that were routinely required to submit very crucial information about just how many pollutants they're discharging into our air and waters, they wouldn't have to report that information necessarily. If they could essentially establish that, you know, they were unable to report that information because of the pandemic. And the way the enforcement discretion policy was written, it really failed to emphasize that the agency still wanted businesses to comply with those requirements as much as possible. And only in situations where there really was no other option would they be allowed any sort of discretion. Instead, the way it was written, it did appear, and this is, you know, what environmental advocates and public health advocates were most worried about, is it did appear to be essentially a rollback on enforcement during the pandemic, and really an excuse to allow for lax enforcement during this difficult time, during a public health crisis, right at the point, you know, at a time when environmental and public health protections are most important. So that's where this all begins, is with that EPA enforcement discretion policy.
Say more about that. Why, you know, if we're looking at oil and gas operations, and your story is looking at continued fracking operations, so production of oil and natural gas, which is certainly a large issue here in Colorado, why does it matter if you care about the pollutants that would come from fracking or, for example, refineries, to not have this information, this enforcement coming from the EPA?
Yeah, we know from a number of scientific studies that people who live close to industrial sources of pollution, whether those are frack sites, coal mining sites, that they tend to have poorer health outcomes. Right. So with fracking, you see people who live within a half mile to 1 mile of a frack site or a number of frack sites tend to have a higher incidence of respiratory diseases like asthma, for instance, cardiovascular diseases, all these underlying conditions that make them more susceptible to some of the worst impacts of COVID-19. Right. They have a more difficult time coping with the disease. And so it's a threat multiplier in that way, if you're living near a source of pollution. So the fact that a number of state agencies and the federal EPA is also indicating to polluters that, you know, we're not going to be keeping a very close eye on you, that essentially means that people who are living next to these sources could be exposed to more pollution at, you know, the very time when their health is critical and they're trying to stay safe during the pandemic.
basically we're talking about self-reported data. I think most people would assume that actually it's the government that's collecting data on pollutants being released from refineries or fracking operations, and they're surprised to learn that it's actually self-reported data from the companies.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Under the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, and under a number of permits that businesses enter into with state environmental agencies and the federal EPA, they're required to report certain specifics about how operations are going, right? Yes, definitely. Most people probably imagine an inspector is going in every 3 months or every 6 months and collecting the data themselves. But in fact, what happens is businesses are the ones who are collecting this data and then submitting it in the form of reports, you know, whether those are daily reports, weekly, monthly, quarterly, yearly reports. There are all sorts of reporting schedules. And the agency's job is to then review that data and make sure that it complies with all of the state and federal laws and the conditions in their permit. So they're really relying on those reports, that self-reported data, to come to conclusions about whether these businesses are following all the environmental rules and regulations in their jurisdiction. So that data is critical to give, inspectors and insight into whether operators are following the laws.
And so this story that you just released today is a deep dive into what's happening in Pennsylvania in the wake of the relaxing of these reporting rules. So please tell us what you found.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been looking into a few different states to see how the pandemic has affected the agency's ability to do its job. And a crucial piece of that is inspections, right? And whether that's on-site inspections or these file reviews that we were just talking about, I was able to get a data set of all inspections that the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection has conducted since January 1st of 2019. And so I did a comparison of the inspections that were conducted the 6 weeks after Governor Tom Wolf in Pennsylvania ordered the state to essentially shut down. And sent DP employees home. And I compared that 6 week period with the same 6 weeks in 2019. And what I found is that inspections overall have decreased by a little more than a third, about 37%. And an even more interesting finding is that the inspections of oil and gas and mining operations have decreased the most. So among all of the inspections, there are different sort of programs within the agency. And there's a division that oversees the oil and gas industry and a division that oversees the mining industry. And those two industries saw about a 70% decrease in inspections. And those on-site inspections have pretty much just essentially stopped since the pandemic.
And yet you haven't seen an equivalent decline in production from those sectors?
I didn't specifically look at production. And, you know, we have seen oil prices drop pretty dramatically in the last couple months, which probably has had an effect on production. But in general, those industries have been categorized as essential businesses. And so they are continuing to operate for the most part, or at least they're allowed to operate. And in fact, the agency is continuing to roll out permits for those industries and other industries. So really nothing about their operations has changed dramatically as a result of the pandemic. But what has changed is the watchdogs' enforcement, right? Whether the DEP is keeping an eye on these industries in the same way that they were prior to the pandemic.
Okay, so as you reported, the agency has continued to process applications for permits allowing drilling, construction, and mining companies to continue their operations, and that these operations were deemed essential so that they could continue during the pandemic. And so what are the conclusions that you draw from this from this deep dive?
Sure. I think one big sort of takeaway is that these state agencies, while on the face of it saying that they are continuing to enforce all environmental rules and laws, and that they're keeping a close eye on these industries, you know, while they're trying to reassure the public and environmental and public health advocates, I think internally they are struggling to do that. I don't want to speak to intention, but I think the fact is that these agencies are really trying to balance protecting their employees with overseeing these industries. And in this unprecedented time, they're really struggling to figure out how to do that. And that what that means, what that lax enforcement means, is that, you know, unscrupulous actors during this time can essentially take advantage of that and get away with a lot.
So different states are providing different information, but it does seem to be really, it's very dramatically by state how the companies have behaved. So you quote Hess in this article, in your article, and Hess is a company that has specifically said in its filings with investors that it has continued to pump the same amount. It's pumping the same amount. It's just storing it out at sea in tankers, and it's hedging its investments so that what it's expecting is that the price of oil will rise in the future, and it will just bring that oil back to shore at that time and sell it at that time. I don't know if that's true specifically for Pennsylvania where you looked, but it's certainly true of this company, and different companies, depending on where they're producing, are essentially behaving differently, also based on the how much it costs to produce. So it makes it very hard for journalists to track. And also, you know, a lot of the industry statements have been, we plan to reduce production, you know, at so-and-so date this year, not necessarily they're currently reducing production, whereas some companies are just immediately shutting in wells. So it's very hard to tell at this point what's happening with production, even though I think people following this sector would expect a sharp decline. And certainly here in Colorado, we have seen far less permits being applied for, but you've also reported here in Colorado, and you've seen that even in communities that have asked to have production stop in the wake of COVID-19, that hasn't happened. So can you talk about your reporting here, just down the road from us in Broomfield?
Sure. That piece was reported with my coworker, Emily Pontecorvo, and we looked at one community's struggle to deal with fracking that's very close to them. This community, Anthem Ranch, is a community of elderly citizens above the age of 65. The vast majority, you know, they're all retirees. And they, for the last year to year and a half, have lived very close to a frack site. And they believe a lot of their health issues, you know, including breathing trouble, nosebleeds, odd sorts of odors in the air, all of that is tied to that fracking that's happening nearby. And they've been fighting that company for a while now. And they were requesting that the company cease operations during the peak of the pandemic, you know, until at least some of the cases decreased. You know, so that they were not having to choose between essentially trying to move out of their homes and in with family or check into a hotel where they might be exposed to COVID-19 versus, you know, staying in place and then having to breathe in these emissions that in the past they believe have caused these negative health outcomes for them. So they've been stuck in a very difficult position. You know, the city of Broomfield was considering issuing a public health order, essentially requiring the company to halt operations. But the company was able to work around that, file for a restraining order, and a court in Colorado sided with the company. So the company's operations are ongoing. Fracking has been, you know, continuing during this pandemic. And these, you know, elderly citizens close to the frack site are having a fairly challenging time trying to figure out, you know, how best to protect their health.
And for listeners who haven't been there, I've stood right at Anthem Ranch. It is, you know, basically a stone's throw away from the extraction operations that that are taking place right there, the fracking operations. The company is called Extraction. The operations are fracking. Can you just say more about what it means for the company to get a restraining order in this case? Who's the restraining order against exactly?
The restraining order, I believe, was against the city of Broomfield, because the city's officials, the city commissioners, I believe, were considering issuing a public health order. And so they were able to make a case to a judge, a local judge, essentially arguing that, you know, they're considered an essential business and the state governor has, you know, essentially given them the authority to continue businesses, and that order would supersede anything that the city does.
Yeah, so this has been a long story of, you know, this is a newly elected local government here in Broomfield, many of whom were elected because they were part of a group of mothers who had been trying to oppose the fracking operations taking place in Broomfield because of the health impacts on their children and on themselves, and then thought that with COVID-19 that it would be clear that if people are being forced to stay locked in their homes, that those operations wouldn't be allowed to continue. And yet you reported on both that struggle and that they have been allowed to continue, even within this ongoing effort to implement SB 181 to try and put in place protections specifically geared at protecting public health in Colorado, rather than regulations that seek to expand upon oil and gas drilling. You know, after having done these two stories, Colorado and Pennsylvania, can you give us some of your, you know, final thoughts on what this tells you about where we are now with COVID-19 with oil and gas, and where you think, you know, communities might want to try to be headed?
Sure. I think, you know, one of the things that COVID-19 is bringing to light is just the various sort of inequities that exist, you know, in our society today, right? It's just kind of blowing the lid off of that and making it all very clear and apparent to us. And one of the ways in which it's doing that is, you know, highlighting some of the impacts on environmental justice communities. The very communities that live close to industrial pollution, often people of color, often low income, they're also the very folks who are also struggling to contain the outbreak of COVID-19 and are also feeling disproportionate impacts from those outbreaks, right? So we've seen all the numbers coming out from whether that's Louisiana or, you know, just across the country, you know, in Navajo Nation, for instance. So I think in some ways it's shedding a light on that. It's just showing us how important it is to tackle these issues in tandem and that they kind of play into each other. And so I think that has been one big takeaway. And with Broomfield, the other takeaway for me was many of these folks who live at Anthem Ranch had plans to move away when the company began flowback, which, you know, is a specific part of the fracking process where the emissions are higher than during other parts of the fracking process. And so they were prepared for this day and had made arrangements to move in with family or, you know, move into a hotel or go elsewhere and be away from the frack site. Except of course, the fracking operations happened to coincide with the pandemic, and that essentially meant that they couldn't travel very far and that proved to be riskier, or at least in their assessment was riskier. And so it meant that they're sort of stuck in this dilemma, kind of not knowing, you know, which option to choose. And so I think That was also really interesting to see, you know, just how this pandemic kind of coming out of nowhere could put people in very difficult positions.
Yeah, there definitely had been a strong push in Broomfield to first try and get those operations stopped. But as you say, people who actually did have the means to be able to go somewhere else during the worst part of the operations, but then unable to do so because of COVID and then being stuck locked at home next to these operations, as you say, at sort of the worst stage of the operations. And then as you're highlighting in the Pennsylvania story, just how the amount of pressure that's also being placed on the state agencies to step in or local agencies to step in. And in this case, the local authority being unable to step in and play that role to try and stop those operations. Really, really fascinating reporting. Thank you so much for joining us. I encourage our listeners to look at Navina Sadasivam's reporting at GRIST, that's G-R-I-S-T, new reporting out on May 26th, and her earlier reporting from here in Broomfield in Colorado. She's joining us today from San Francisco. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us now is Lucy Molina, a community organizer in Commerce City. Lucy lives within blocks of the Suncor refinery, which operates there. Thanks so much for being with us, Lucy.
Hola, Antonia. Muchas gracias. Thank you so much for having me. God
Thank
bless you.
You
all.
Thank you for being with us. I have had the pleasure of visiting your home and being in Commerce City and have had the displeasure of standing right next to the refinery. But for others who haven't been there, can you tell us a little bit about the refinery and about the community that you live in Commerce City?
Sure. Thank you. Gracias, Antonia. Again, also, thanks for the work that you do and the opportunity to speak. Well, I'm from Commerce City. We are very well known. That is one of our biggest landmarks, the Suncor. But we're also known by like the dog tracks that used to be here. We have the flea market. So we have some pretty cool stuff here. We also have the Rocky Mountain National Animal Rescue here. So animal refuge. So we're known for other things, but more unfortunately, we are more known by our famous, which I call my deadly neighbor, Suncor refinery here in Commerce City, that has been pretty much polluting not only this community and surrounding communities, but the entire globe, pretty much what almost a century. So they've been here for like over 70 years. What I call is environmental racism and environmental injustice for these communities that are living here. Suncor is, I would say, the big thorn in our shoe here in Commerce City. This is a low-income community, as many people know, which is one reason I moved here, because of my situation at the time that I moved here years ago. I was forced to, you know, this was the cheapest place where I could find where me a single mother can live with two kids and a sick mother. So this is pretty much the norm here in Commerce City.
And so as you say, a largely immigrant Latinx community, and you've told me before also a large undocumented community. So people in somewhat precarious positions when it comes to seeking out, for example, government service, healthcare, other forms of support.
Yes, and we can see that now as well. Antonia, we can see that here with this pandemic that's going on right now. That is the same situation that's happening right now. We have people that are probably sick here, have no food and means to pay their bills because, you know, most of us lost our jobs. And they don't have access because of their immigration status, okay? So that puts us, the rest of the people, no matter who you are, it is a public public health threat, you know, for all of us, you know, because, you know, we're still working together. We're still neighbors. We still have to interact with each other, and that is, it just puts another strain in this community that is already devastated by almost 100 years of exploitation.
Well, so we have, for those who don't know, the Suncor refinery is the only oil refinery in the state of Colorado. And I think many people have been paying attention to the news and seeing that there has been studies, including a really well-known one now out of Harvard, finding a correlation between exposure to air pollution, particularly volatile organic compounds in the air, and death rates associated with COVID-19. The reason being, this is a respiratory disease. It attacks the lungs. If your lungs are already exposed to pollution and continue to be exposed to pollution, it makes it harder for them to fight off the infection. And what we also know is that Suncor has a long history of breaking the law when it comes to releasing pollution into the Commerce City community and breaking clean air standards and clean water standards. I think some of us have been seeing in the news, though, that refineries haven't been operating as much in the wake of the crisis because people are driving less. And that was true for a few weeks once the crisis began, but now we're seeing refinery utilization rates, how much they're operating, including in the Rocky Mountains, and actually particularly in the Rocky Mountains, just shoot up again. Can you tell us what your experience has been, you know, living next to this refinery? Have you seen a change in the amount of and in how much it's operating, and if, you know, that's resulted in changes into air quality?
They're flaring as we speak, okay, right now. So no, and not here in Commerce City. I don't feel it has been decreasing. At least in my city, I feel it has increased because we just had an operational upset also in March of this year, just what, a month, in the middle of a pandemic, if you will. And we had no notice. Because the last time we were informed through the school, the school sent us a message letting us know what was up with Suncor. But in March, everybody was out of school. So we did not get a message from the school. I found out through Facebook. That's
can
how
you,
I found
can
out.
Can you tell folks who don't live near refineries what an operational upset means?
Yes, an operational upset is basically, malfunction. It's a malfunction of their whatever they're doing over there. So what it does, it shut down and it emits all this gunk up in the air, which is all the VOCs. Benzene, cyanide, all these things. I just say it's poison, okay? Because it's poisons that are emitted into our air, whether it's flaring or not. And when these operational upsets, what happened last time, Antonia? You know what they offered? Now this gunk, this yellow gunk goes all over our houses, our cars, our earth, our dirt, our grass, our trees, our animals that are outside, our dogs. There's horses here. We have farms. And guess what they offered us? They offered us a car wash, okay? A freaking car wash, okay? These things cause cancer. Okay, we live in the lowest performing district that has, we have half of this community has underlying conditions that are now exposed to now an even more deadlier pandemic. These organizations, I say, they're savage, and they have no regard for the human health, the earth, and the damage that they're creating to this entire earth as a whole, because we're not only contributing to the death and the environmental racism and injustice in this community, but we're also contributing to the destruction of this planet. Adams 14 is the lowest performing district in the state. Okay, now they do connect the air that we breathe. It is connected with learning disabilities, with asthma. We have one the highest asthma percentage here in Commerce City. I mean, that's a big red flag right there. I mean, they cannot say that. I mean, this is directly connected with VOCs and all this poisoning that we are forced to breathe, you know, because, and I say we're forced because even though we want to make change, there's no one that helps us do it, you know, unless we rely on changing the laws. Not only, then we also have undrinkable water, PFAS, okay, which also is caused by industries like this. Commerce City has not drinkable water. I mean, we don't have a leadership that can provide clean water to their residents. We don't have that, much less clean air. So we depend on these formats, on organizations that are fighting for us to come and educate the community. And you know, and pissed off mothers like me, Antonia, that, you know, I'm tired of seeing my son with bloody noses, my daughter having migraines, my aunt has cancer again for the second time. We're going to go through chemo again in 2 weeks. This is, you know, this is a reality of this community.
Okay. And you're saying this is a community that is suffering from a host of pre-existing problems, and you're saying many are associated with the pollution there, and of course your own family. And you were telling me that your mother also suffers from diabetes. So can you talk about what the COVID-19 crisis has also meant to your family, to this community?
Well, one thing is it's very scary, Antonia. I mean, one, it's my mother, and you've met my mother. The scary thing is, like, we have to have these virtual meetings, right? Like doctor visits now. They're afraid, and my mom cannot go. I mean, the doctor strictly said we don't want her out of the house. She needs to stay at home. This is dangerous for, you know, people like her. And then in Commerce City, we have so many diabetics. We have a lot, especially a lot of Latino, you know, immigrant community suffers from diabetes here too. So it's really frightening, honestly.
And how many people have been diagnosed with COVID in Commerce City, and how many people have died?
Well, as of now, actually, as of May 26th, I'm going through Adams Tri-County Health, is 2,908. And then we have 112 deaths.
In Commerce City alone.
In Commerce City alone. There's a lot of fear, and at least personally for me, knowing that not only I have a deadly neighbor here that can go off any moment, but also an invisible enemy and poison out there that we have to breathe, you know. So it's a very there's a lot of fear and anxiety, and you know, we're scared. There's a lot of fear mostly I see here, and at least for me, you know, with my kids having, you know, migraines, I know that every time it flares here, every time something happens here in Commerce City, I can tell by my migraines. I can tell by my kids that they start having more bloody noses, or, you know, we can tell by our physical ailments how this industry is killing us. So little by little, every time something else is happening in our bodies, again, I'll go the example with my aunt. You know, in 2 weeks she's gonna have chemo again. Okay, this is again. She's in the area 80216, which is the most polluted area code in the nation. This is where we grew up. I'm just on the other side. This is Commerce City. We're both in opposite sides of the refinery. It's sad to see that it's become a norm for us. This is a normal for us that we know that eventually we're gonna die from cancer, from leukemia, like my grandmother did, like my aunt did. Like, you know, a lot of my neighbors have passed away from cancers. It's a norm. This shouldn't be that way. We need to start having accountability, transparency. We need to start taking care of the people, you know, because
what does it mean to be, you know, everyone has to stay locked inside of their homes next to the refinery? Although also you're saying that a lot of this, you were telling me earlier, a lot of this community are people who have to go to work, who are among those who are having to go to work at the same time. So how much has been being locked, you know, having to stay in place in home next to the refinery, but then also having to go to work in jobs that may not be safe either?
Well, let's just say, like a couple days ago, there was a fire next to the refinery. Okay. Now this was at night. Okay, now we go to sleep every night, Antonia, not knowing if we're gonna wake up the next day. Just let's put that into like, you know, that's really the reality here. We don't know if we're gonna wake up the next day. In this case, it could be COVID. With us, this thing could explode any minute. it's that dangerous that, you know, we don't know what's gonna happen, you know? So it's a pretty detrimental and scary situation that this community is has been living through the last almost an entire century. I think it's time that we start making changes.
And I'll just ask the last question. What would you like to see happen to the refinery?
In a real world, you know, every time I pass through there, Antonia, I always tell my kids and my whoever's with me, I tell them, look, these are the future hanging gardens of Commerce City. So shut it down. We know it's a dying industry. We are killing the planet. There has to be a change. And I believe 100% where the problem lies, where the problem is, which is this is our big problem here in Commerce City, then there is where the solution lies. So we need to start bringing renewable energy programs. We need to bring green opportunities to this community where we can transition our workers. Our communities need to start. We need to start seeing these type of transitions in communities like these, because we are always the ones that are left behind because we're being exploited by industries like these. So I would like to see in a real world, shut it down. You know, I see the future hanging gardens of Commerce City here, or, you know, just like right now we're seeking strong legislation, no self-regulation anymore, air monitoring that is paid by them, not by us, the taxpayers, which is what they're doing now. I would like to see more accountability, transparency, and I would like to see this community being compensated for all the damage that has been caused to it the last 100 years.
Great. Well, thank you so much. Our guest, Lucy Molina, a community organizer in Commerce City in the shadow of the Suncor refinery. Thanks so much for being with us, and my best wishes to your family for a healthy recovery for your aunt, your mother, your children. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Antonia. God bless you all.
That does it for our show this morning. I've had the great pleasure to be your host. My name is Antonia Yuhas. We've been joined by three stellar guests: Emily Holden, environment reporter with The Guardian US from Washington, D.C., Navita Sadasivam, reporter with Grist, joining us from San Francisco, and of course, Lucy Molina, resident and community organizer in Commerce City, site of the Suncor refinery. Thank you so much for joining me this morning. I hope you have a great day.